As a thankful recipient of many, many skincare products over the years, I've learned to discern what is naturally actually activating my skin to rebalance and recalibrate on its own. That's what your skin is meant to be doing, and it keeps getting disrupted by all these choices that we make. So, when the founder and creator of Herbal Face Food reached out to me, I was all ears. I didn't know why at first. It turns out that Herbal Face Food is the most potent antioxidant skincare line on the market today, period. The raw plant ingredients in each of their products are never processed, never manipulated with synthetics or emulsifiers. These anti-aging botanicals are combined with the most precious plant concentrates, and they have changed my skin. Here's how. I'm going to talk about two of the products, the Herbal Face Food serums and the cream. The serums contain powerful phytoenzymes and antioxidants. These are activated and infused into your tissues. They hydrate and increase the resiliency of your skin, and they feel like they're plumping up your face. I use serum 1 daily. I use serum 2 when I'm tired and I need extra firming for my skin. And I use the X, which is also known as the cure, for a small patch of rosacea that flares up every now and again, which you cannot see because of these products. When you feed your skin with Herbal Face Food, you will feel real live ingredients at work. An activating flush, an invigorating tingle, some warmth, all of these are evidence of your skin healing at the cellular level and years of damage reversing. The cream is the most potent moisturizer I've ever tried, and I've tried them all. I live in the high desert. This cream contains 102 of the world's most powerful anti-aging botanicals and is also the world's first and only edible SPF with a protection rating of SPF 50+. And this is accomplished 100% by plant power. And you can expect intense hydration, soothing for your tired skin. You can expect to see inflammation calmed and rebuilding of elasticity, so your complexion looks and feels more smooth and more radiant. Herbal Face Food is not plant-based. It's plant-powered. It has the highest rating on the ORAC anti-aging scale. ORAC means oxygen radical absorbance capacity. I never knew what that meant before. The highest, over 30 million on that scale. By contrast, vitamin C in skincare rates under 100,000. Herbal Face Food is using all post-consumer recycled materials and packaging. They use glass and aluminum, which is super easy to recycle as well. The products and packaging are 99% free of plastics. They contain no ingredients that involve the destruction or harm of any plant, animal, or marine life. These are 100% plants only, these products. These active concentrates are coming from the seeds, the fruits, the leaves, or the flowers of the plants only. These products have been a complete revolution for me. I know that you will love the way your skin looks and feels after using it even for just a day or two. And the best part is that Herbal Face Food has offered us, you, my community, a code to receive 20% off forever, ever. The code is capital ELENA 20. Once again, that's my name in all caps, Elena 2020. The site is herbalfacefood.com. The code is all caps, Elena 20. It's not just your first purchase, it's any purchase. You will love these products, and I am so grateful, Herbal Face Food, for the change that you have made in my life. Thank you. Welcome to the Practice You podcast. My name is Elena Brower. Let's dive into today's conversation regarding life's myriad transitions and how we refine our responses in our relationships, our wellness, our households, our work, and in our practices. You are invited to learn and love and listen with me. Welcome to Practice You. Welcome back to the podcast. Someone I deeply admire today, an author, a teacher, a Jungian psychotherapist, certified chaplaincy educator, sensei, Koshin Paley Ellison. welcome to the podcast. I'm so happy that you're here, bowing deeply.
A joy to be here with you, Elena.
After many years as a chaplain and a psychotherapist, Koshin co-founded the New York Zen Center for Contemplative Care, which offers contemplative approaches to care through education, personal caregiving, and Zen practice. And today, New York Zen Center's methodologies are internationally recognized. They have touched the lives of literally tens of thousands of individuals. Koshin is a world-renowned thought leader in contemplative care. He's the author of a book that I am holding right now that I love so much. It's called Untangled, Walking the Eightfold Path to Clarity, Courage, and Compassion. He also wrote a book called Wholehearted, Slow Down, Help Out, Wake Up, which I plan to read and report on for my chaplaincy training. Mm-hmm. And Awake at the Bedside. He's the co-editor of this collection of contemplative teachings on palliative and end-of-life care. I'm just really deeply excited and honored to have you here. I want to start right away with a couple of questions from Untangled, if I may.
I'm here to be with you.
Page 13, my lucky number. Making the Eightfold Path our place of practice catalyzes inner change that radiates into our external lives, from everyday interactions to our most intimate relationships, you write. The true pleasure it creates is one that calms us, grounds us, sustains us, making the bad times more easily borne and the good times even better. You go on to say, I've spent the last 35 years of my life practicing the Eightfold Path. When you make a home in it, it makes a home in you. So I'm so happy to touch upon this. I don't think I've ever really sort of dived in the way that I have with this book. And I want to ask you to describe for a lay practitioner or somebody who might be interested in Zen, who might be listening to us, particularly my partner, James, who can't wait to meet you. How would you describe the Eightfold Path? And how would you describe making it into a practice?
Well, now I'm curious about James. And,
You're going to love James. You and James are going to be like fast buddies. Wait till you meet him. He's such a New Yorker and he's so your speed.
So at a certain point, I think that many of us, probably people who are listening to what you're talking about here on this wonderful podcast about practice and practicing with our whole body and mind. And at a certain point, at least for myself, it came to a point where I realized I was being dragged around mostly about my fears. And my fear was really about being actually experienced as myself, as without armor and without having to control what people saw. And once I was able to have that deeply humbling moment and really receive it, I realized that in many ways I was still approaching a life of practice with picking and choosing and really deciding, well, I'll practice if the conditions are right. I will be kind if there is something in it for me. I will, you know, really give it my all, or I'll just try. But if it doesn't work out and I get uncomfortable, I'll retreat.
Yeah, that sounds very familiar.
Yeah, like so normal, right? Like I was a person. And still am a person. Mm-hmm. And I think what is so amazing about the Four Nobilities is that there is a nobility that Shakyamuni Buddha outlined for us, that there's a nobility in our suffering, in our nobility in like when we're staying and picking and choosing, which to me is a place of deep suffering. Like we all just kind of know what that's like when we're kind of waffling, when we're kind of living our life more by hesitation than by action. We're having a big gulf between what we say we care about and what we're actually thinking about and actually talking about and actually doing. I mean, this is all me, you know, like I had this deep experience of these things about being so devastated to see so clearly this mirror. And so the beauty of the path is that first we have to have the nobility of like, oh, it's noble. Like there's a importance of honoring how I've suffered and not to stay there. That's very important. Like that's one of four. And so the first nobility of that and is moves us into, oh, there's also a second nobility that there are causes to our, you know, my grandmother called it suras, you know, like what we suffer from, basically how we create our suffering, which is historically through our greed, our resentment, and our fundamental delusion, which is separation, that we think that nobody will know the suffering we've seen or no one will really understand us. All those ways.
We're alone.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
yeah.
So wrenching, isn't it?
Soros.
Yeah.
I love that. I was also raised Jewish, so I get it. I like that. I think James is actually going to find this really helpful because the picking and choosing, the causes and conditions, all the things that we take for granted as factual, we find out are actually not factual at all. And I think what you've outlined here is not necessarily a path in a linear fashion, but as you say, also on page 13 that I circled, picture the eight aspects of the path like spokes on a wheel.
Right.
Leading into a central hub. That's so helpful. I've never heard it talked about like this. But that central hub is where we find pleasure, the joy of the path, and anywhere on the wheel is walkable, including all the roads, the outer rim, the central hub. There's no arrival point. And this is what I would love for our listener to hear clearly. And for me to remind myself and also James, like there is no graduation. Roshi Jones says it all the time. There's no finish line. You're never really graduating from this. What you are doing is spending more time within that central hub, as you say, of peace and pleasure, really.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, right now we're in the middle of a practice period, which are these 90-day practices. And we're studying Kodo Sawaki Roshi. And, you know, he talks a lot about how important it is to really see how we're functioning. Like, it doesn't really matter what we say. It really matters what we do. And so we could be a Buddhist teacher, we could be whatever we are, and it really matters what you do. So like, how are you actually functioning? I always like to think for myself, like, how am I treating the barista and the waiter and the sanitation person? You know, how are you awake to the interdependent web that we're actually in a very ordinary way, involved in.
Yeah. I think in chapter two, you talk about the tangle. Who's going to untangle this tangle? But specifically for our listeners, softening your narrative. And this is something that I identified with, of course, right away. You write, in my life, I've struggled with the narrative that I am a victim, a story I inherited from hearing my family talk about the Holocaust. My great uncle was imprisoned in a concentration camp. My grandparents would often talk about their extended family being killed for who they were. My grandpa George used to hold up a book called The Indestructible Jews and say, remember this, we will always be victimized. This is a big topic right now. And as a Jewish person, I'm pretty sure I can speak for both of us and say all we want at this juncture in early 2024 is peace and no more war. Period. Full stop. And that is hard for my Jewish counterparts to hear. And I wonder if you could address that in the ways in which you address it in your contemplative practice, in your teaching for us.
Yeah. I find this time excruciating, actually. And both a feeling of equanimity at this time, which I feel is a place of refuge for me, and for all of us to really see things with a sense of equanimity, which is like that kind of grandparent, grandmotherly mind, looking out and seeing people hurt themselves in the playground. And you're like, oh, yeah, we'll patch that up. And to the mind where Shakyamuni Buddha at the end of his life going, visiting his family home and seeing his extended family all slaughtered by the neighboring clan. and continuing to teach. Like that kind of equanimity I'm finding deeply necessary. So when people say, you know, oh, I'm feeling sorry for this group of people or that group of people, I always get concerned because I feel like we're always leaving someone out. And so for me, the Bodhisattva vow is to realize that, you know, in thinking about what's happening in Gaza and Israel, like to me, the point is to realize that I am not separate from anyone in that situation, from the people who are being blown up, to the people who are raping women and men, to little babies, to children, to both governments, and that I'm not separate. And for me, maybe more than peace, I'm really looking to cultivate a mind that can hold it all. And to me, this is Shakyamuni Buddha's example of going back and seeing his family slaughtered and still continuing the path of Buddha Dharma that we have today, thanks to his dedication. And you never heard him say that who was good and who was bad, but that how do we settle our mind so that we're not taking sides and not forgetting the 450,000 people who were slaughtered in the last few years in Syria that we don't even hear about, or in Africa at this time, that there are people being slaughtered.
30 other wars, I think, going on.
Right now. And when we get kind of caught by one, like we're like magpies in a way, like, oh, there's a shiny thing. And but we're to not forget that atrocity is part of the world and has been since the time of Shakyamuni Buddha or our friend Yuval Harari, you know, like his incredible work. It reminds us that for at least several hundred thousand years, we have been doing cruel things. Human beings do cruel things to other human beings. And I think that this is very humbling. And my friend Shakil Chaudhry, who's a beautiful thinker and in the work of diversity, and he and I have been having a series of conversations that have been deeply meaningful, and talking about that just any group has who's been oppressed tends to then become the oppressor. And that is true in almost every country. And it's so important to remember, like, oh, this too is true. And to me, it's been more helpful to focus on this larger truth than any particular outcome. Like, to me, I'm using kind of all of my energy to widen the circle of compassion, as our dear Bodhisattva Albert Einstein reminded us to do. He's like, our work is to keep widening out the circles of compassion.
Einstein said that.
Yeah.
Wow.
A good Jew.
A good Jew. A good Jewish boy.
Yes.
You say on page 18, to your point, rather than simply repeating the same mistakes over and over, we have to learn how to direct our thoughts and then our actions differently. And we can do this by finding shelter in our place of practice and acting from there. This is the underlying principle of walking the Eightfold Path. I really appreciate that. Wow. You talk about intimacy, and this is something I'm slightly obsessed with right now, getting beyond and getting intimate. And for our listener, when we're talking about intimacy here, we're talking about intimacy with our own minds so that we can create a mind of safety, a mind that we can rely on, a mind that we can turn toward to find that shelter that Koshin is speaking about. You talk first in this section about the gate of sweet nectar, and I thought it might be interesting to talk to our listener a little bit about this particular liturgy/ ceremony, because We've all but lost ceremony in our lives, and I love the fact that in my Zen practice, it's back. It feels so good. Mm. Tell us about the Gate of Sweet Nectar.
Well, I'm not a Buddhist historian, but my understanding is that the Gate of Sweet Nectar and another ceremony that we call Fusatsu, which is a renewing of vows, are one of two of the oldest ceremonies. So it's very, to me, super helpful to remember. Like, one is that we have to keep renewing our vows regularly. Like, it's easy to say we have a vow, but are you really practicing it? And as my teacher, Genyoko Jima Roshi, talks about that, he's very clear that to maintain the precepts, we must at least half of the time be atoning. Be half the time actually just taking full responsibility without any defense. And to me, that's a very beautiful part of Fusatsu. And then this other ceremony, the Gate of Sweet Nectar, which is such an amazing title, first of all. Like, who doesn't want to enter that gate? And
I swear. And the ceremony at Upaya involves like some pretty amazing dancing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just love it so much. It's such a thing that I look forward to.
So great. And it's really a ceremony of first feeding all the hungry spirits, you know, all of the insatiable parts of ourselves. That's going back to that second nobility of realizing, oh yeah, our insatiable greed, our insatiable resentments, our insatiable delusions. Like, we have to feed all of them. The hungry ghosts who are, you know, sometimes the image is so great, you know, just of these little tiny straw-like necks and these big bellies and these big mouths, and they are just starving. And one of the images that I love so much of hungry ghosts is, you know, somebody's brought into a room and says, you know, there's this huge banquet of delicious food, and all the hungry ghosts are sitting at the table, and they have boards tied to their arms so that they can't bend their elbows, and they have forks and spoons, but they can't get the food in their mouths, and they're so crazy. And the one person says to the other, like, what's this? And they said, oh, this is hell. This is hell. So the Gate of Sweet Nectar is addressing and honoring that hell. And then you go into the next room in this parable, and the next room has the same table with all the gorgeous food and all this beauty. And except the hungry ghosts are so happy because they're reaching across the table and feeding one another. And because they can't feed themselves. So in some ways, the Gate of Sweet Nectar, I would say, is very much moving from this impoverished mind to this very joyful mind of, I see you, and I will feed you, and I will shelter you.
So beautiful. Thank you, Element, for sponsoring the Practice You podcast. We have been personally using Element for well over a year. Element is spelled L-M-N-T. Elemental electrolyte salts that have completely changed the game around my house. Every night before bed, James and I split a packet. Helps us sleep, helps us get good solid rest, and helps combat fatigue, muscle pain, fogginess, irritability even. Did you know that your cells need electrolytes for optimal function? And if you're struggling with any of those things, you might just be deficient in electrolytes. They facilitate hundreds of cellular functions in your body, including nerves, hormone regulation, nutrient absorption, fluid balance. Element contains 1,000 milligrams of sodium, 200 milligrams of potassium, and 60 milligrams of magnesium. No artificial anything in here, no sugar, no nothing. My favorite flavors, as I said, orange, watermelon, and the chocolate caramel in hot water is just incredible. Element comes in tiny single-serving packets you can carry with you wherever you go. They're great on planes as well. With my link, you get a free sample pack with any order so that you can try all the flavors. And that link is drinkelement.com/Elena. The spelling is D-R-I-N-K-L-M-N-T drinkelement.com/Elena. Thank you. Thank you so much again, Element. Again, the link, drinkelement.com/Elena. You write about it as compassionately feeding our inner demons with care to reduce their pain. I'm instantly transported to this moment in my life where my kid was young and I was reading Thich Nhat Hanh's book, Anger, and figuring out how to care for my anger, which was the only way I was ever going to get to the bottom of why it was even in my world. And that really made a big difference for me. And to hear it said this way also was extremely helpful. On page 21, you talk about this interaction that you had with a guy by the name of Robert. It was actually Chodo, obviously. His weekly appointments, he kept on seeing this interesting woman, piercing blue eyes, bald head, walking around the place, mentioned to his supervisor how sad it was that this woman had cancer. And his supervisor laughed. "She doesn't have cancer," he said. "She's a Buddhist monk. You should go talk to her." Mm-hmm. The next time he saw the woman, Chodo, your Chodo, cornered her in the hallway and said practically all in one breath, "Hi, my name is Robert. I'm really interested in learning from you. I'm an alcoholic and former drug addict." He went on and on and on. He was talking nonstop, word vomiting all over the poor woman. He thought it was so important to share his narratives about who he was, because through them was how he engaged with the world. And James and I were just talking about this. When he was finally done, the woman responded, "Well, you know what you need to do." And Chodo said, "No, I don't. Tell me." And she goes, "You need to shut the fuck up." And it's so cool because I swear, when I come home from practice period, James is like, "So what'd you learn?" And every time I'm just like, "Well, I have to shut the fuck up."
Yeah.
And then I read your book and I was just like, "Oh my God." In the Zen tradition, you go on to write, "We don't mince words." Shut the fuck up can be pretty good advice when we are loving and clear. And to walk the Eightfold Path, first we need to learn how to stop and give ourselves a break from the tape we're constantly playing. So this speaks obviously to our age. You were probably born in the 70s or earlier, if you know what the word tape means. But what's interesting for our listener for today is, can you tap into the sort of running narrative, the running thread that you have going through your head regarding this person or that circumstance or this place or that task that you have to do? Your calendar, your schedule, your work, your family, that person in your life. There are so many of those running. And the best thing that I really got from this book was stop the presses immediately. Notice the tape. Care for the tape. Notice what it's doing as you go through your life. And choose. Maybe you can choose. James is in the middle of choosing this right now. He's been talking about his dysfunctional family for his whole life. It's so sad. It's deeply sad, actually.
Yes.
And he's finally choosing to not let that be the sort of defining factor in his preamble to anyone he meets, which I think is really interesting. And that's the invitation for our listener, I feel.
It's a very powerful practice. You know, in the book, I talk about this meditation that I found myself drawing to while I was writing this book about, you know, this for so many years, I had created this armor. And then I realized that what the armor had become, which was very useful, you know, because I grew up in an environment with enormous amount of violence, you know, physical violence, emotional violence, sexual violence. And so I was grateful for the armor. But I realized now as an adult, which was many times, just having to go back to that to really see like, oh, my armor has become a cage. And at a certain point, we need to really learn how to open the front of the cage and step out. And I feel like that's actually such an important part of growing up, or I often like the expression adulting, kind of adulting ourselves into it. Like I can put on my big person pants and I'm scared shit and I am nervous and It's uncomfortable and it feels unsafe, and I can do it. I can take a step forward.
Chapter 7, you turn to the quote-unquote pivot. Hmm. And the subtitle to this chapter is Finding Our Place of Practice. And throughout this chapter, for our listener, I really suggest, even if you've never considered Buddhism, you are not going to become a Buddhist, doesn't matter. This is such a wonderful way to organize your thoughts and your mind and your heart. You start like this, and this is, I read this to James the other day. It was so helpful to him. We recently saw his mom through medically assisted death, and it was absolutely exquisite. We hospiced her for a couple of months, and then it was like the most thoughtful, caring, beautiful, magical, sacred, wild witnessing. I'm on page 91 in Untangled. Shunryu Suzuki once said, quote, "After you've practiced for a while, you will realize that it is not possible to make rapid, extraordinary progress. Even though you try very hard, the progress you make is always little by little. It is not like getting into a shower in which you know when you get wet. In a fog, you do not know you are getting wet, but as you keep walking, you get wet little by little. If your mind has ideas of progress, you may say, oh, this pace is terrible. It's going too slow. But actually, it's not. When you get wet in a fog, it is very difficult to dry yourself. So there's no need to worry about progress. And I forget the exact context in which it came up, but I ran over to your book remembering this. I read it to him because I'd folded the page twice. I knew exactly where it was. And I said, you know, sitting in the Zendo is like this. Continuing to go to Upaya or the New York Zen Center or anywhere is like this. You're walking in a fog. You kind of don't even realize you're getting wet. And suddenly you're soaked. And it's really hard to dry yourself off. You're steeped in this practice. And you find yourself breathing a little differently, a little more fully. You have a little more space for strife in your life. And like you said, you're sort of widening your parameters, your purview. And things start to have more space around them so they don't take up so much of the real estate in your mind and your heart. And something changes. And it's so beautiful.
Yes.
So beautiful. Soto Zen. I wanted to touch on this because I'm sure I have a couple of folks who will be interested in finding out why Soto Zen versus Rinzai or any of the other options. I think in Japanese, I'm learning a little bit of Japanese, Soto means outside. And I thought it might be fun to talk about that a little bit with you.
Hmm. Well, it's so interesting because I was raised in the Zen world, and similar to you, in the White Plum tradition, which is really a deep mashup of Rinzai and Soto, which I didn't really understand.
Right, right. And, koan plus practice, shikantaza.
Yeah, but even how we do kinhin, like so many things, I was like, wow, you know. But now I'm working with a Soto Zen teacher from Japan and learning such a great deal. And one of the things that he talks a lot about, you know, he teaches at Eheji at the main monastery and is the 40th abbot of his temple in Japan in Enna City. And what he talks about is how important Dogen's teaching, who's the founder of Soto Zen, that making it really accessible, which sounds weird, first Japanese teacher to write in Japanese and instead of in Chinese. And people hated him for it. And he really felt that this needed to be accessible to the farmer. So it's often actually thought of in Japan as farmer Zen. Actually, I like even better.
Yeah, it echoes outside.
Yes.
You know, in a funny way. Because it's in, but it's out.
The palace, you know. And,
yes, totally.
And the main thing is harmony. That the main interest is harmony of the whole. In Japan, what you'll see very often is that all the different temples, there's might be many, like even in my teacher's town, there's many temples, and they all help each other. Help each other do ceremonies. They help each other to do different things, or a temple from another city needs help. And so like priests or monks from practitioners go and help. As I've learned, is really core part of the Soto Zen way is like, actually, how are you supporting one another? How are you supporting those that you think are not you? And that's a good barometer for our practice. And so like that felt like actually one of the biggest surprises of learning about Soto Zen for me, is because it was not really the focus of how I was raised in the Zen tradition. And I just really am feeling very moved and touched by it. And going with him to watching him taking care of people is very, very beautiful.
It's kind of nothing like watching somebody who's fully committed to this path presencing someone else.
Yes.
It's the best lesson, no words.
Exactly. You know? Just watching. He actually had me go to a monastery that had just kind of been finally repaired from 78 years ago in Nagasaki. And so there's this beautiful monastery called Kotaiji, which is one of the few international training monasteries where people can go. And I had the opportunity to train there and recently. And it was just really beautiful. And my practice instruction from my teacher was just to just watch, see how people function. And most people didn't speak. There was not a lot of speaking. So you just watch what people do and how moving it is. And he's like, this is the Soto way. Like to see how people are in harmony and then maybe fall out of harmony and come back into harmony. Mm. It's so beautiful.
It is. It's what drew me to really dive in and study at Upaya was the fact of no teaching. It was really just come, watch, learn, follow, fall in. And it's precisely how it happens. And if, you know, I bow at the wrong time or turn the wrong way, somebody's, you know, either there to let me know in a nice way or they don't. And they wait for me to get it myself.
Right.
There were things it took me a year to get that I laughed so hard at how many times people must have seen me do this incorrectly. And now I know. I mean, it's so sweet. Thank you for that exposition. I took my son to AHG last year.
Oh, no way.
I did. And it was beautiful. He was very moved by the experience and by Japan in general. And I'm going back this year with Roshi and a group of us for a proper pilgrimage to Sojiji.
I'll see you there.
Oh, no way. We're going to get to meet. Oh, I was just picturing how nice it would be to sit next to you, just feel each other and hold each other up.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
We'll have that opportunity.
Page 100, turning the wheel. I love this part. I wanted to teach our listener from your mouth to their ears the places of practice. And we can't go into so much detail on this, but I do want to read this to you, our listener, because I think what Koshin is touching on here is really beautiful and a really great way to find your way. Perspective is the first place of practice. It means shifting from what has been done to me to what I am doing.
Hmm.
With regard to others, it means finding a way to compassion through facing our own suffering. The second of these places of practice, intention as a place of practice, means asking the question, how do I seek a happiness that doesn't involve exploiting other people or doing them harm?
Hmm.
Oh my goodness. From the most extractive society on planet Earth, we are asking ourselves this question, and basically everywhere I turn, I have to look over my shoulder and say, oh my God, that too. I have to stop that too. Speech, third, as a place of practice, means speaking with reflection, generosity, and a resistance toward falling into the easy habitual patterns of thoughtless or harmful speech. Words have power. How are we using them when we talk to others as well as ourselves? The fourth place of practice is action. Action as a place of practice means getting in touch with our values and being clear about what those values are. You've heard the saying, quote, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. This is because our actions are our true belongings. And that's such an ancient teaching. They are a clear indicator of whether we are walking the walk and not just talking the talk. Mm. Work as a place of practice means having some consciousness in our livelihood and our work and not separating it from our values or our mindfulness, because one third of our lives is actually spent at work. And this has been, since reading it this summer, a real lighthouse for me. This idea of work as a place of practice, it's helped me to define and refine my hours spent, my money earned, taking less, and learning so much more and so much happier, sleeping so deeply, volunteering with almost half my time. Final two, effort as a place of practice means we have to make a good effort. We were talking about this just yesterday. As Rainer Maria Rilke wrote, it's hard. It's hard to change, to stay steady, to have a creative and vital life. How we summon the energy for change and transformation is also a place of practice, you write. And then finally, attention is a place of practice. And that means cultivating the kind of focus and presence that allows real change. The path itself is in the midst of this gap and the tension of that gap between our values and what we actually think, say, and do. That is where the path is, in that weird sort of chasm between what we say we stand for and then what we do. And until we can sort of close that gap, it's really attention is needed. It's a life, as you write, of living with curiosity and awareness and paying attention to the ground of it. Also has helped me tremendously in the last several months to commit really and define what I am doing going forward. I'll never stop thanking you for this. But I wonder, of all of those, perspective, intention, action, speech, work, effort, attention, where are you sitting right now in your life as the sort of, if there were to be a primary or maybe primarily secondary places of practice, and why?
Well, first of all, I feel very moved and I feel very received. So I'm really appreciating you, Elena. And for me, it feels very much what feels alive. Maybe because we're studying Dogen's One Bright Pearl right now. But to really see that it's our life is not a metaphor, and that one bright pearl of existence is everything is all included inside of this one bright pearl of existence. And so what does it take for me to kind of, I love the expression giddy up. It's like one of the translations of Svaha at the end of the Heart Sutra. You know, at the end of the Heart Sutra, we say Svaha, which means sometimes it's translated as giddy up. You know, yeah. It's like, let's do it. Let's move from our suffering story and our suffering mind to freedom. Let's giddy up. Let's actually, as Shundo Oyama Roshi, who is this incredible national treasure of a teacher in Japan and the Seido at Sojiji, and she often talks about, like, what we can do is work with the conditions. We can nurture awesome conditions so that we can be more loving and more clear and more fearless, which I always have to restate for myself, which is to feel the fear and do it anyway, to step forward, to peck in and peck out all at once. That's what feels super alive for me right now.
Yeah. Thank you.
Giddy up.
Giddy up. You know what's wild? James's mom, we had a priest at her death, and we also had the Heart Sutra playing. Kodo Rowan's wife, Nicole, she goes by the name of Neil with two L's at the end, N-E-I-L-L. She has a beautiful track of the Heart Sutra. And I was playing it while James's mom took the medicine that would slowly shut down her organs and end her life. And her last freaking words were, "Is this the Heart Sutra?" And she died. I mean, what kind of karma is that?
Pretty cool.
Right?
Yeah.
The last question I wanted to ask you, page 188, you talk about how protective it is to have routines. Boy, is this a conversation that happens all the time. Should I have a routine? Should I not have a routine? Should I break my routine? What's going on? And you're right, it can be protective of our practice to have routines. I have a morning routine I follow almost every day. First, before I've even opened my eyes, I do my own version of a Jewish practice called the Modeh Ani, which entails calling to mind five things I'm grateful for. How great is that? Do you also say that prayer?
I don't say the prayer, but I find the practice delicious.
It is delicious.
Makes opening your eyes totally different.
Yeah. Since you wrote this and I read this, I find myself when I'm really stressed waking up in the morning, there's some, you know, I feel like I'm getting in trouble all the time. You know, the water people call, I must be in trouble. The HOA calls, I'm definitely in trouble. It's such a nice practice to do when I feel like I'm getting in trouble. You go on to say that you take care of your cats, you visit the small altars you have around the house, and you sort of put some care into each one, and then you exercise for about a half an hour. You have breakfast, coffee. All of that, including breakfast, is a place of practice, you write. It's such a beautiful way to look at things, you know, and I offer this to our listener because I wish I could just go through the whole book with you right now. But given our time constraints, I just wanted to sort of point that out and ask you, is there anything that you would like to share with our listener regarding the importance of that, you know, sort of loose routine or any wisdom that you might want to share?
Well, hard one is earlier in my life, I had this idea of freedom, which meant not committing to anything, was freedom. And over time, I found that the deeper I go into things and the more committed I am, the more alive and more possibilities unfold. It's almost like the exact opposite from what I thought freedom was. But freedom, in my experience, really comes from rigor and discipline. Doesn't mean to be cruel, but to be rigorous. Like come on, giddy up, we can do this. Am I really doing the things in my life that actually support me? Am I seeing friends? Am I cultivating awesome friendships that feel actually supportive? Am I actually having some time each day where I'm not thinking? And I'm also not zoning out, but I'm actually learning how to be with silence and learn how to settle my mind. Am I moving my body so that I can be as healthy as I can for as long as I can? You know, just these kind of basic questions to me are so wonderful to have as a Dharma adventure, as a place of practice that literally I experience most things as places of practice. Like, oh, right now, talking to you.
Yeah.
Am I alive?
Am I awake?
Yeah.
Giddy up.
Giddy up.
I love it. Oh my God. That is like a perfect place to land, actually, in the freedom of rigor and discipline. I have found that to be true. It is such a beautiful thing to be a mom of a teenager, having found this path a few years ago and being able to install some of the teaching and the centeredness, groundedness into our interactions. So I really appreciate that. The rigor has caused freedom for both of us in our individual lives and in our little collective life together as mother and son.
So beautiful.
It's really cool. I could talk to you all damn day. I cannot wait to see you in Japan to make sure we find each other.
Well, it's not going to be hard.
Nope, it won't be hard. And what I will do, I'll send you an email with my phone number so we can text.
Awesome.
There. And I just so appreciate the time that you've taken. It's quite a bit of time, longer than I usually go on my talks here. And every moment has been one bright pearl. Indeed. Thank you so much.
It is a treat to spend time with you. And I look forward to seeing you.
Yes. Sitting with you. If we can do it, it'll be so sweet to sit with you. Thank you. And you have to meet the phenomenal humans that practice at Upaya who are coming on this trip. You're going to love.
And you'll get to meet the phenomenal humans who practice with us.
Yes.
Be together.
And is Chodo coming?
He's not coming. No.
I see. Okay.
He'll be holding it.
We'll have to work with that.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much, brother. Thank you.
Be well.
You too. Thank you, AG1, for sponsoring the Practice You podcast. My listener, you've been hearing me talk about AG1 for some time. I think I've been taking it daily for almost 3 years. 75 high-quality vitamins, minerals, whole food-sourced superfoods, probiotics, and adaptogens in one scoop in the morning. The best way to start your day. Supports your gut health, your nervous system, your immune system, your energy, recovery, focus, and longevity, the conversation of the moment. The taste is delicious. It's suitable whether you eat keto, paleo, vegan, dairy-free, or gluten-free. It contains less than 1 gram of sugar. No nonsense in here at all. It's a multivitamin that your body will actually absorb. If you are wanting to make an investment in your health and longevity, AG1 costs you less than $3 a day, far less expensive, and definitely less time-consuming than many different supplements. Reclaim your health, arm your immune system with convenient, delicious daily nutrition. And since you listen to the Practice You podcast, Athletic Greens is giving you a free 1-year supply of immune-boosting vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. All you have to do is go to athleticgreens.com/Elena. Once again, that's athleticgreens.com/ELENA. Take ownership of your health, my listener. And thank you, Athletic Greens and AG1.